This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Thank you for downloading this edition of The Report. This week, Hannah Barnes investigates the state of the forensic science industry in the UK.
DNA evidence has been at the heart of a number of high-profile criminal cases in recent months. Two men were finally convicted of the murder of Stephen Lawrence, thanks to new forensic discoveries, and a failure to eliminate a police scientist who'd contaminated the body of MI6 officer Gareth Williams led detectives down the wrong path for 18 months. In the report this week, we explore the flaws with forensic evidence. We'll hear from some of the world's most eminent forensic scientists that DNA is not a magic bullet that can solve any case.
We were at great pains to talk about the limitations of the evidence, and it seems to me that much of this has been forgotten or swept by the board.
We'll speak to people who fear that laboratory mistakes in the processing of DNA are undermining investigations.
It sent shivers down my spine. If I didn't know the facts of this case, I would think them to be fiction. Now, I certainly won't be accepting DNA evidence on face value.
And 6 months after the closure of the National Forensic Science Service, we'll assess the impact of changes to this industry on the criminal justice system.
Knocking the door very early hours of the morning, saying I was being arrested for the murder of Anne-Marie Foy in 2005.
Retired taxi driver David Butler.
6 months I was being bailed each month. And then in June, I was charged and hauled off to Walton Prison. And that was when Alice fell down a hole, I'm afraid. Everything went upside down. Whole life changed overnight.
I met Mr. Butler at his solicitor's office in central Liverpool. He looks older than his 66 years. Frail and ill, he tapped his walking stick on the ground as he told me how in 2011 he was charged with a brutal murder.
I was asking, well, what evidence you got? And they were, well, we believe it's you because of DNA. And then they told me about the crime scene stain from 1998, which alerted them to me. It was in the national database from a cigarette butt, which was at the scene of a burglary at my mother's home. And they said, with the advances in DNA technology, they believed that my DNA was on the body. I hotly denied and disputed it.
The police claimed to have found David Butler's DNA on the body of Anne-Marie Foy. But what they had was something known as a mixed, partial profile. It was made up of many different people's DNA and of low quality. The police said that Mr. Butler's DNA was on the victim's fingernails, a cardigan button and a bandage around her leg.
The DNA evidence never got any stronger than their initial, could be possibly partial profile.
I mean, most people listening would think someone's DNA is found on the body of someone who's been murdered.
Yes.
It's only right that the police call you in for questioning and
absolutely
ask you about it.
I had no... if they thought that was my DNA, of course they're doing the job. If they think I'm a suspect, I'll prove that I'm not a suspect. The DNA has become the magic bullet with the police, I believe. They thought it was my DNA, ergo, it must be me.
Because of the lack of clarity in the DNA, David Butler's legal team questioned whether it belonged to him at all. But even if it had, David's solicitor, Paolo Martini, remains far from convinced about the strength of the evidence.
The experts said, we can't say it was him, but similarly we can't say it's not him. Now, the problem with that is when you get into the realms of we cannot exclude, suddenly huge portions of the population of this country could not be excluded.
All other evidence proffered by the prosecution was shown by Paolo Martini's team to be wrong, including the claim that a taxi caught on CCTV driving past the murder scene was being driven by David Butler. But despite this, Mr. Butler remained locked up in a high-security prison, awaiting trial.
It was hard. The loneliness is the worst. The despair. Not speaking to your family. Excuse me. I've got three great sons, four lovely grandchildren. What was it going to mean to them? I've led a good life. I've had a good life. I've been a good man. And this to me was an absolute horror story.
The nightmare continued for 8 months before the case went to trial in January this year. David Butler was eventually acquitted after a forensics defence expert explained the weakness of the DNA evidence and rubbished a statistical probability that he was responsible for the crime. David's solicitor, Paolo Martini, is scathing in his criticism.
I think in the current climate, it's made police lazy, because unfortunately the police at the moment have too little money to do their job in too little time. And it doesn't matter how many times someone like me will write to them, as I did in this case, and implore them to reconsider the evidence, to look to their guidelines and to drop the charge against David. I was wrong, and they put every hope they did or they had in the DNA results.
At trial, Paolo Martini called upon DNA expert Dr. Sue Pope from Principal Forensic Services.
What I was asked to do was to look at, first of all, the DNA results that had been obtained from a specific set of samples, mostly to do with fingernails, bandages on the victim.
When Dr. Pope began looking at the details of the case, it became apparent that there were a number of explanations as to how David Butler's DNA could have been found on the victim. To begin with, she had been wearing glittery nail varnish, making it far more likely that the DNA on any object she touched could attach itself to the nails. But crucially, it emerged that Mr. Butler had a severe skin condition. He was even nicknamed Scaly by his fellow cabbies. And this meant that he shed skin and left much larger traces of DNA behind than the average person. His DNA could quite easily have been transferred via money or another person through contact in his taxi.
Most people might not understand that different people leave different amounts of DNA behind them. How much can it vary by? I mean, there's three of us sitting around this table right now. Could we all be leaving completely different amounts?
Yes, that's right, you could. And not only that, the same person might leave different amounts in different conditions. If their hands are dry or if their hands are particularly sweaty, they might leave different amounts.
We asked Merseyside Police to comment on the criticisms raised about their handling of the case. They said that a forensic scientist was able to identify the DNA evidence as belonging to Mr. Butler. And this, along with other evidence, satisfied the Crown Prosecution Service that there was a sufficient case to be presented to a jury. They told us that the inquiry into Anne-Marie Foy's murder remains open and the force will continue to investigate. Is this case a one-off, or does it tell us more about some deeper problems playing out in the world of forensic science? Well, to answer that, we need to take a step back. In March this year, the Forensic Science Service, the national provider of forensic work for England and Wales, and which also provided backup for Scotland and Northern Ireland, was closed down by the government. That left behind a largely private market in England and Wales with three companies, LGC Forensics, Orchid Cellmark and Key Forensic Services, making up the lion's share. Now, the idea of a market in forensics is nothing new. It's been growing steadily over the last two decades. But a major turning point was the introduction of the National Forensic Framework Agreement by the police in 2007. It was this that broke down forensics work into different lots, like drugs, DNA crime scene stains and violent crime, which companies would then bid for. Dr. Sue Pope.
The current situation is that the police take a greater role in the decisions that are made about what tests to carry out on a particular item. And the problem with that is that it commodifies things into tests rather than having someone looking at taking an overview of the whole item or case and deciding what the most useful tests might be. And I think that there are occasions, and in a case like this, where something's lost by this process.
Jo Millington has been a forensic scientist for 17 years and is a specialist in blood pattern analysis. Like Sue Pope, she believes that the breaking down of every aspect of forensic science by price and test type is having a worrying effect.
If you're provided with a menu whereby you have to select a particular option, then that drives your decision-making process into a little box.
When the Forensic Science Service closed, Jo Millington transferred to the Metropolitan Police. having now left the Met, she's worried that decisions in many forces are being made largely on a cost basis.
Add to that a system whereby you have people making these decisions with no forensic training or awareness of the strengths or the limitations of forensic science, then it becomes increasingly difficult for them to understand what happens once they tick that box. In some cases, the wrong test has been asked for, because there isn't an awareness of what is the best test to apply in any one circumstance.
So this is a lab we can actually go into.
Managing Director of Key Forensic Services, Paul Hackett, is taking us on a tour of their high-tech laboratories at the company's Coventry headquarters. The so-called fragmentation of forensic science that Dr. Sue Pope talks about has been brought about by a combination of breaking down everything into individual tests alongside a growing trend of the police bringing more work in-house. This has split criminal cases between labs like this one and internal police labs.
So, more DNA labs.
And in this lab here, we've just moved to another one. There's a sort of a crash test dummy. what are they doing in there?
If we wanted to recreate a situation where how would the blood have got onto this garment in this manner if it were being worn naturally? What we'll sometimes do is dress the dummy up in similar clothing and just have a look at how the blood may have got there.
And it must be not just difficult, but impossible to do that kind of analysis if you've only been sent a small fragment of the original item.
Oh, entirely impossible, yeah. I mean, the most common situation arises where perhaps a murder weapon, a knife which has been used to stab somebody, is swabbed. The swab is submitted, and the question is there blood on the swab, and can you send it for DNA profiling? And then later on, the question becomes, perhaps in the courtroom, was that knife the murder weapon? And of course, as forensic scientists, we could potentially answer that question if we'd examined the knife. The fatty tissues may have been deposited in a manner that allows us to say, yes, it's gone into a depth of 4 centimetres. And we could say, yes, well, this knife has gone through a green cotton T-shirt and a white cotton vest. And all that other evidence clearly is not visible on the end of a swab. There's risks associated with that approach, admittedly.
Given the concerns over the separation of the evidence-gathering process from the analysis in a growing number of cases, are the police similarly worried? Chris Sims is Chief Constable of the West Midlands Force and the Association of Chief Police Officers' lead on forensics.
If someone is suggesting to you that at some point in the past a scientist looked at everything found from a scene, that is just never been the case. There is always has to be judgments in this.
I don't think it's being suggested that everything would have been looked at previously. Of course, you're completely right that judgments are made. It's that the process is now split, and that's the problem.
I think fundamentally, though, the process has always been split. There's always been people who are gathering evidence, people who are analysing the evidence, people who are performing scientific tests on the evidence. That isn't new.
I've come to The Hague in the Netherlands to a gathering of some of the world's most eminent forensic scientists who are here because of the European Academy of Forensic Science Conference. And I'm here because I'm told that the changes taking place in the UK are going to be a hot topic of conversation.
So what do we have here? Epithelials from the airbag. Would you mind checking it to see if it matches the saliva from our spitting champ?
This scene from CBS's hit TV series CSI shows a suspect tracked down and ultimately convicted thanks to DNA evidence, all processed in just a matter of seconds. But when that clip was played at one of the lectures at the Hague conference, it was greeted with howls of laughter and vigorous shakes of the head. My producer and I looked on bemused. I've always been rather impressed by the skills of lead detectives Mac and Horatio. But the speaker was touching on a problem which forensic scientists across the world are beginning to see, and one typified by the David Butler case. It's referred to as the CSI effect.
Match confirmed. Forensic proof. Glavo did it.
It's the idea that DNA is to be believed at the expense of all other evidence, or even in cases where no other evidence is offered at all. In David Butler's situation, the only thing implicating him was a low-quality, partial DNA profile. But there are other instances where the DNA is the sole evidence linking someone to a crime and where the sample itself appears to be more clear-cut.
He had been arrested on suspicion of rape, said to have occurred in Greater Manchester, and that his DNA had been recovered from the crime scene. His instructions were, I've never been to Manchester, therefore I did not commit the rape, and the DNA, there must be some kind of a mistake.
Criminal solicitor Philippa Jeffries was called to defend Exeter-based Adam Scott when he was charged with rape on the strength of DNA evidence alone.
DNA evidence can't be wrong. If your DNA is there, then your DNA can't have got there by magic. And I think he was gravely concerned as to the consequences for him, rightly so. Challenging DNA evidence is no straightforward matter. My concern was, what other explanation could there be?
Well, the sample in this case had been contaminated at the processing laboratory of private forensics company LGC. And in March this year, more than 4 months after Adam Scott was charged, the Crown Prosecution Service dropped the case against him. LGC say that a plastic tray containing a sample taken from the Manchester rape victim that should have been thrown away was instead reloaded into the lab's new automated processing system. It was then used again to process Adam Scott's DNA, which was being analysed as part of an entirely different police inquiry.
It sent shivers down my spine. If I didn't know the facts of this case, I would think them to be fiction, because it is the stuff of nightmare and every crime drama that's ever graced our screens. What a narrow escape, I thought. This is a miscarriage of justice narrowly averted.
This case is causing concern to many forensic scientists, including one of the two men who developed the use of DNA profiling in criminal cases, Professor Peter Gill. With a career spanning 3 decades, much of it at the Forensic Science Service, he says the error serves as a warning about what he perceives to be an over-reliance on DNA evidence.
When I was at the FSS, we were at great pains to talk about the limitations of the evidence, and it seems to me that much of this has been forgotten or swept by the board. This is typified by the Adam Scott case. There was a fail-safe in our recommendations which stated that police should never charge anyone on DNA evidence alone.
Given the concerns raised by scientists, suspects and solicitors, I asked ACPO forensics lead Chris Sims whether he recognised that some officers were falling back on DNA when there was no other evidence available.
The role of the police is always to gather as much evidence as possible, and the decision-making is then not ours but the CPS. DNA evidence on its own, it can really never ever form the entirety of a case. Really, all most forensic evidence is saying, in terms of identification, is it saying that that person left that sample. And there has to be a much broader understanding of the scene and the circumstances to understand and interpret what that means.
While we've been making this programme, we've spoken to a number of people about the Adam Scott case, and everyone we met at the conference at The Hague was worried about its implications. Professor Peter Gill.
A DNA profile does not come complete with flashing neon signs saying that this sample is contaminated. You only know there's an error if you spot it. But what it does mean is that there are hidden errors in the system. You can't say that this is a one-off. It's simply not true. It's not scientific. And there could be hidden miscarriages of justice. It needs a complete review.
The forensic science regulator is investigating what went wrong at LGC, and his office told us that his findings are due to be published next month. I met with the company's managing director, Steve Allen, in a quiet room at the Forensic Science Conference. He said he couldn't talk about the details of the Adam Scott case for legal reasons, but I asked him whether he was concerned about mistakes.
Well, of course, we take every incident very seriously. Just to put it in context, we process around 250,000 samples every year. Our scientists are not infallible. There's judgment and interpretation in every case that we get. We're not the first public or private provider to have made mistakes. The mistakes have been made in the past and they will inevitably happen in the future. All we can do through our quality systems is to make sure that we learn from them and put them right.
LGC Forensics say that they have subsequently introduced a system to ensure that all used trays are labelled and clearly identifiable as clinical waste. And they sent us the following statement.
To ensure that there had been no further instances of sample-to-sample contamination, LGC checked all 26,000 DNA results that had been obtained since the new equipment was introduced and identified those where the same profile appeared in more than one sample. LGC's scientists then checked each of these to confirm that there was a legitimate reason for the profiles being the same. For example, they were from the same case. This confirmed that no other incidents of sample-to-sample contamination had occurred. The methodology and results for this exercise, as well as the corrective actions, were independently audited.
It's worth noting that before its closure, the Forensic Science Service also made mistakes. Most notably, it missed vital forensic evidence belonging to the perpetrators of the murder of South London schoolboy Damilola Taylor. LGC is now the biggest player in the industry, with a 50% share in forensic science work handled outside of the police forces. Increased competition has helped drive down the price of forensic work and reduce turnaround times too. Backlogs have all but been eliminated, comparing favourably with other parts of the world. So there have been clear benefits for the criminal justice system. But just how stable is this market? The government closed the FSS because it was losing money. Back in Coventry at the Key Forensics Lab, I ask Managing Director Paul Hackett if the private sector is faring any better.
Looking at Key's accounts for last year, you made a loss of £2.9 million. It seems very competitive and difficult to make money in this market. What makes you think you can make it work? And is there a danger that one of you will fail?
What I would say is that Key Forensic Services has been positioning itself over the last 3 years and has been investing heavily. And this year we will generate a profit for the first time.
Key Forensics, starting in 2005, start to turn a profit in 2012. Why would anyone invest in this industry?
Well, if you asked me that question, would I have invested in Key Forensic today had I known that where the market was heading and the challenges? I guess if I was really, really honest, probably not. However, we invested 5 years ago and we've been making every effort to compete and grow the company. I think you can make a profit in this industry.
The market for forensic work is increasingly unstable, making life difficult for private providers. In 2010, police forces were estimated to spend £170 million with external forensic service providers. The Association of Chief Police Officers put the figure at £100 million for the current financial year, a 40% reduction in just 2 years. Unlike Key Forensics, LGC did make a profit last year, but a modest one. Across the whole company, of which forensics is only one part, it made a profit on ordinary activities of £856,000 on a turnover of £132 million. Well, why does this matter? Well, what would happen if one of the main providers were to withdraw from the market? Could the criminal justice system cope? Well, it's our final day here at the European Academy of Forensic Science conference in The Hague, and we're off to hear from Conservative MP Stephen Metcalfe. He's talking about the Science and Technology Select Committee's inquiry into the closure of the Forensic Science Service.
Now, one of the things, key recommendations we made in our report was that we thought the government should do something to help stabilise the market so that there was a level playing field for forensic science services.
What do you think will happen if one of those large providers now makes the decision that they can't make it work, that they leave the market altogether?
If one of the larger players pulled out of the market, it would create huge instability, and I'm not sure that that would serve the criminal justice system particularly well.
We wanted to speak to James Brokenshire, the minister in charge of closing the Forensic Science Service, about the fragility of the market left behind and whether it has the capacity to cope in the event of one major player leaving. But he wasn't available for interview. A number of factors explain the rapid shrinkage in this market, but the most important is the growing trend of police forces conducting more forensics work in-house. Stephen Metcalfe again.
My concern is external labs have to be accredited. Police labs, who are basically internalising the work, don't.
Laboratories achieving this international standard have been assessed as having good quality control systems in place, and the reliability of their technology and testing has been looked at. If private forensic science providers are struggling to make money, and the police continue to take more work in-house, will it be carried out to a high enough standard?
It's very worrying that evidence might be assessed using unaccredited laboratories.
This is all about criminal justice. Is there a danger that if results are coming from unaccredited police labs, that they're somehow going to be questioned in court?
Well, that has to be a worry, if not having evidence produced in an accredited lab is an avenue open to those in the defence realm, then, yeah, they may well use that.
Of the 43 police forces across England and Wales, currently only 5 have been accredited to the internationally recognised standard. 4 more have been recommended for accreditation, and a further 23 have submitted applications to start the process. We asked the Home Office about how this discrepancy in accreditation had arisen and why police labs were allowed to carry out forensic work without it. In a statement, they said,
"All police laboratories work to extremely high standards. The police service is committed to ensuring that all police laboratories will be fully accredited to examine DNA by the end of next year and fingerprints by 2015. Accreditation by the UK Accreditation Service is a means of having independent verification that appropriate standards are maintained. It follows that non-accreditation doesn't prove the standards are not being maintained."
So where does this leave the provision of forensic science in England and Wales? The closure of the Forensic Science Service has left behind a market split between largely unaccredited police laboratories, 3 main private providers who are operating on tight margins, and a dozen or so smaller commercial firms who will pick up some of the more specialist work. It's to one of these that Jo Millington, formerly of the FSS and the Met, is heading. But she is clear who's losing out in the current system.
Everyone. The scientists. The science has been diminished. The criminal justice system. Because I don't think it's presenting a comprehensive evidence that really does do the best for that evidence at each particular stage of a case.
What about the victim?
Well, I think in any case, that has to be your absolute paramount priority. And I think if you're not doing your best by each stage of their investigation, then ultimately, you know, they're losing out.
The UK is widely acknowledged as having been a global leader in forensic science, with developments made here changing the way crimes are investigated across the world. Comments from delegates at the European Academy of Forensic Science conference made clear that it's still highly respected. But in seeking to cut costs and time and creating a menu of tests with individual prices, there's a danger that our forensic science industry will be less able to cope with the demands of a sophisticated criminal justice system. And if that results in more unsolved crimes and more miscarriages of justice, we may find that spending money on getting the forensic science right in the first place would save a lot more in the long run.
The report was presented by Hannah Barnes and produced by Charlotte Pritchard. You can download more news programmes from the Radio 4 website.